This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
So thank the people of New Hampshire for a great victory tonight.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Bernie Sanders right now is the front runner in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. For some in the party, this is some kind of nightmare. They say he's too far out to the left, out of touch with voters, that nominating Sanders is the best way to guarantee Donald Trump a second term. For many others in the Democratic coalition, Bernie Sanders isn't just a front runner. He's the very future of the party.
In politics, I believe you make the odds. Your energy, your support can change the odds from looking bleak to looking pretty good.
That's Keith Ellison. He served as the deputy chair of the Democratic National Committee before becoming the Attorney General of Minnesota. And he recently endorsed Bernie Sanders for president. I reached Keith Ellison in his office in Minneapolis.
I just thought, you know, Bernie's political and economic program and his basic approach to organizing and the fact that he got arrested for civil rights protests made me think that he had the right program and had the right approach to mass organization and organizing to move that program forward.
He did surprisingly well in 2016, or at least he surprised a lot of people.
Yeah, he did.
But there were still a lot of voters there who thought, I don't know, this guy is too left, he's too radical, too ideological for me. Now it's 4 years later. And there are still a lot of people who seem to feel that way, and you see them voting for Klobuchar or Buttigieg. What's the argument you'd make to those people about why they shouldn't be afraid to vote for Bernie Sanders?
Well, I mean, are they afraid of Franklin Roosevelt? I mean, in 1930s, some people thought a minimum wage, you know, the Wagner Act, labor rights, people thought that NLRB or rural electrification was so radical, or Social Security. Now we take these things as like basics. In 1968, 17 different states had it to be illegal for a black person to marry a white person. Now, people don't bat an eye. A few years ago, we thought gay marriage was an impossibility. And one day, we're going to take Medicare for All as a basic. Paid family medical leave. We're going to say, yeah, this is how civilized societies are organized.
What do you say to the voters who say, yeah, okay, Franklin Roosevelt always called himself a liberal, not a socialist, which is a fact. This guy, he caucuses with the Democrats, but he's an independent.
I will tell you that I do reject this idea that Bernie's not a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, what is the Democratic Party other than the values that it stands for? The dignity of work, the dignity of labor, civil and human rights for everybody, a fair economy, social inclusion. And who exemplifies that better than Bernie, right? There are a number of people who are quote-unquote Democrats who do not vote with the Democratic mainstream nearly as often as Bernie does. He's taken on leadership within the Senate Democratic Caucus in terms of outreach and engagement. And I can tell you, as a member of Congress for 12 years, there's nobody who doubts Bernie's commitment to Democratic values or even working with Democratic colleagues. So I think that's a red herring. You know, I really do.
Mr. Ellison, the theory of the case in the sort of Klobuchar camp and the Buttigieg camp is the following, that this race is going to come down to a handful of states, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, and so on and so forth, and that their ability to win in those states is way higher than Bernie Sanders. You obviously disagree. Bernie Sanders obviously disagrees. What's your theory of the case on that?
For a specific reason. Because I don't think your average voter thinks, oh, is this left or is this right? Is this conservative or is this liberal? what they ask themselves is, can I afford this or not? If you go to farmers in Ohio and you say, you know what, you worry about your dairy farm, we'll worry about you getting health care. Some of them are going to say, that sounds all right to me. I've always wanted to keep my farm. I'm not sure we could even survive. If I had Medicare for All, that would change my life. I mean, you go to those same dairy farmers and you say, you know what, we're going to get tough on immigrants. And some of them dairy farmers are going to tell you, who's going to milk these cows if you kick Jose and Yolanda out of here? Mm-hmm. How am I going to make this farm work? People do not make 40,000-foot ideological decisions. People are like, I don't know what you're talking about. What I'm talking about is keeping my farm. I'm talking about keeping this factory open. And that is where I think Bernie really sells, even in places that we think might be more attractive to a quote-unquote centrist. The people there may have a more socially traditional way of life. That doesn't mean that they're not hurting economically. I'm telling you, they're going to listen to a leader who says, you know, we're going to actually try to solve some problems. I got something for you. We're going to do rural electrification. Somebody might say, oh, that's socialism. To the farmer who benefited from that program, they say, hey, I can turn the lights on in my farmhouse, whereas before I couldn't.
You are intimately familiar with Bernie Sanders and the Bernie Sanders campaign of 2016. How has he changed in those 4 years? How has the campaign changed?
Well, I think that the campaign is far more sophisticated than it used to be. Bernie is better known than he was before. Bernie's philosophy has soaked in and actually become really mainstream. I mean, and if you watch those debates, man, the question wasn't, well, what should we do about healthcare? The question was, well, is Bernie's idea perfect or does it need some refinement? Elizabeth said, yeah, well, you know, here's how we pay for it. And then Pete says, oh, well, I'm love for it, but I'm for this other option. And everybody else is sort of like making a refinement on Bernie's ideas. Bernie has truly captured the ideological victory here. And it's not just on Medicare for All. It's also on free college. It's also on the whole marijuana discussion. I mean, Bernie has changed the landscape in terms of what issues it is possible to even be for.
Why did he capture the moment and not Elizabeth Warren? They were very, very similar.
Well, I think that there are essentially two reasons. One is that Bernie, I mean, you can click up old photos of Bernie and here he is being dragged off because he's protesting in favor of fair housing in Chicago. Bernie just has a level of credibility. I mean, he is for what he's for. I mean, people hear politicians, today I'm for something, yesterday I wasn't when it wasn't popular. Bernie's like, you know, popular or unpopular, Bernie Sanders is Bernie Sanders through and through. And in the meat grinder, which is Washington, you know, you need somebody who's going to stay who they are. You know, so I think that Elizabeth Warren, you know, just plain old doesn't have that clan kind of history. You know, I also think that Bernie has really deepened his organizational. I mean, he really believes in organizing in a way, not just for a campaign, but for a social change. And I think he says quite often that if you're going to make changes that are going to truly increase the wealth and income of poor and working class people, you will need a sustained mass movement to drive that change. And I don't know if Elizabeth has spoken to those issues in quite the same convincing, compelling way. But I got to tell you, I'm a big fat fan of Elizabeth Warren. I think she's an awesome person, and I she has done a lot for this country and this race.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Anytime, man.
Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison. A debate, a real divide, is coming into view. On one side, you've got supporters saying that Bernie Sanders is the progressive future of the Democratic Party. And on the other, you've got centrists and party elders saying that Sanders is inevitably going to lead to a disastrous loss in November. Nathaniel Rakich is an election analyst for the data news site 538, and he spends most of his time studying polls and trying to figure out what exactly voters actually think. Nathaniel, unlike the vote counting catastrophe in Iowa. I think we now know who's won the New Hampshire primary. Tell me about the shape of that win for Bernie Sanders. Did he perform as forecasted? Did he exceed expectations, or did he come up short?
You know, he did come a little bit short of what we at 538 were predicting, but I don't really want to oversell that or read too much into it. I don't really see it as a sign of weakness. I know a lot of people are talking about, oh, he won 60% of the vote in New Hampshire in 2016. He's from a neighboring state. He should have done better than this. I think that's a little bit disingenuous. You know, in 2016, obviously, it was a two-candidate field. You're not going to be able to get 60% of the vote in a 5 bazillion-way field the way that it is right now. Plus the fact the electorate is different. It's a different composition of the electorate. In 2016, you had a contested Republican primary. This year, you didn't really. And so maybe some of the folks who are more moderate, maybe Republican-leaning, maybe wanted to jump into the Democratic primary instead, voted for somebody like Buttigieg, who has more of a unity message. People shouldn't read too much into it. This was a expected, but solid win for Bernie Sanders in New Hampshire.
Now, when you look at the numbers and the polling data, who do you think poses the biggest threat to Sanders being the eventual Democratic nominee? Is it clearly Pete Buttigieg, or is there a more complicated answer to that?
No, I actually don't think it's Pete Buttigieg at all.
You think it's
in particular,
Biden?
His struggles with non-white voters. Yeah, I think if I had to choose one other candidate, it would be Biden. You know, he is still second in the national polls. He still probably is looking good in several Super Tuesday states.
Despite the miserable performance in Iowa and even worse in New Hampshire.
Those two states were never demographically great fits for him. I think that if the first two states had been Nevada and South Carolina, we'd be having a very different conversation, frankly, and a lot of that is just pure luck. That said, I do think that, you know, with every kind of unsettled results we get, so for instance, in Iowa, I think you had 5 different candidates getting national delegates. In New Hampshire, it looks like it's going to be 3. Every state that votes that gives delegates in a very scattershot way increases the chances that there's going to be a contested convention, which is honestly almost as likely as an outright Sanders nomination at this point.
Just a couple of weeks ago, The Atlantic ran an op-ed titled "Bernie Can't Win." And a couple of weeks before that, the New York Times ran an op-ed titled, "Of Course Bernie Can Win." According to the data, which of those op-eds is correct?
Of course Bernie can win. You know, look, he won the New Hampshire primary. He won the most votes in the Iowa caucuses. I believe the only candidate to win the nomination without winning either Iowa or New Hampshire was Bill Clinton in 1992. Sanders, in many ways, you know, perhaps not ideologically, but resembles Donald Trump in that he is a factional candidate with strong support, very passionate supporters among a certain part of the party. And a lot of people assumed in 2016 that Trump wouldn't be able to expand that support, but of course he was able to do so. And I think that that's true of Sanders. I don't think there's a lot of evidence for this idea that he has a ceiling of support. He's popular among the overall party. I think his approval rating within the Democratic Party is at somewhere like 70%. So it's not like there's a huge block of anti-Sanders voters out there.
Let's imagine Bernie is the eventual nominee of the Democratic Party. How does he do in the polls when stacked up against Donald Trump?
You know, I want to start off with the caveat that early general election polls have not been very accurate historically. That said, you know, to the extent that they do mean something, you know, Sanders does okay, but really all candidates do fairly similarly, I think, as a result of our polarized environment right now.
But that's a popular vote assessment, right? It's not a state-by-state assessment of how the Electoral College would come out.
Right. So sometimes you'll see a poll of, you know, Florida specifically that shows a head-to-head matchup between them. But yeah, I'm talking right now about national polls.
So Bernie Sanders, when he answers the question of beating or not beating Trump in the general election, his theory of the case is that he is not so much running as a candidate as the leader of a movement, and that this movement will bring out unlikely voters, not only in states like New York and California, but it'll also bring over voters in the essential counties in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan. The theory of the case of his opponents is that Bernie will be painted as a left-wing ideologue to such a degree that there's no way he will get those votes in the crucial states, and he will lose an electoral college to Donald Trump. How do you see the numbers going? And I know it's early.
Look, I think that historically speaking, all other things being equal, more moderate candidates or candidates basically closer to the median voter have performed a bit better than more ideological candidates. That said, there is a lot of political science evidence that that gap is decreasing and may even be gone now, again, because of the polarization. People basically are like, I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat and I'm going to vote for this person because I hate the other side so much. On the other hand, I think that Sanders makes a good point that there are clearly voters that he has turned out in the 2016 election in particular who wouldn't be ordinary voters, you know, younger voters in particular. He's very popular among. I think it's too early to know whether he's turning out those same people here in 2020. You know, again, because of polarization, his left-wing ideas wouldn't necessarily hurt him that much, but say they hurt him by 3 points in some of the suburban counties in, say, Pennsylvania or something like that.
Well,
that
let's could be look enough. At those. Let's look at those key states for 2020: Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, even Ohio. Can Sanders win those states?
The national political environment is the most important factor for that. Right now, it looks like the environment leans Democratic by a few points, maybe 4 or 5. It's enough to put those states into play. In particular, I think about Wisconsin and Michigan. He does have a good argument that he would be able to appeal to a lot of the people who voted for Trump, not necessarily out of any ideological agreement with him, although maybe they do agree with him on things like trade, but because they just feel like the system isn't working and they want to take a stab at something kind of at a radical departure. And Sanders would certainly represent that. I think it is harder to make the case that he would be able to win places like Arizona, Texas, places where kind of affluent suburban voters have put those states into play for Democrats.
You know, Donald Trump has been in office now for more than 3 years. And his base is as solid can be, but he has never cracked 50% that I know of in job approval ratings. And yet, Democratic voters and many independents who dislike him are not only terrified that Trump will win, some are even resigned to the idea. How do you answer that?
It's true that Trump has a very poor approval rating historically for a president. Basically, Gerald Ford was the only president with a worse approval rating. But on the other hand, it's certainly possible that he'll win, again, going back to polarization. So right now, in our approval rating average, Trump has an almost 44% approval rating, which is actually among the highest that he has had. And if you were to take that literally, he has a 44% approval rating and a 52% disapproval rating. Obviously, he would lose the election if those were the final vote totals. But I think that you do have to factor in the fact that this is a 50-50 Democratic-Republican country. He'll probably overperform his approval rating a little bit. And once you start getting into the 47%, 48% territory, that's when you start to wonder, well, even if he loses the popular vote again, the Electoral College could still help him out because there are several states that are just a little bit Republican-leaning and, he could win those states and lose the national popular vote and still be elected president.
Thank you very much, Nathaniel.
All right. Thank you, David.
Nathaniel Rakich of 538. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with much more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Josh Rothman is an editor at the New Yorker, and he's been spending a lot of time in the last few months in high school.
So we're at Townsend Harris High School in Queens, and this is an amazing school. It's like one of the best high schools in New York City. We're in the elevator, and we've just arrived on the day that Townsend Harris's presidential election simulation is kicking off.
This election simulation Josh is talking about is a pretty big deal at Townsend Harris. The school has been doing it for 25 years. All the kids in the senior class participate, and they play different roles: candidates, journalists, pundits, even super PACs. And then the entire school gets together and votes.
The goal is to try to get the whole political reality and compress it down into something the size of a high school. And this is our third year going back. So I love coming back to Townsend Harris to see the election simulation. It's a little freaky because you're seeing our political craziness reflected in, you know, these kids who are encountering it for the first time. But it's also, you know, really great to see how fully and creatively they inhabit the roles that they've been assigned.
We have to put our foot down and say that our democracy is not for sale. My name is Elizabeth Warren. I know what's broken, and I got a plan to fix it. And that's why you should vote for me on Election Day. Thank you.
The students started their campaigns in September, right after school started.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Who are you?
Oh, I'm Miss Kamala Harris.
That's awesome. What do you think about the real Kamala Harris?
So from what I know of her, I think she's a pretty rad dude.
All right, Sai, who's up next? Bernie Sanders? Is this guy still alive? All right, Colonel Sanders, come on up.
We will have Medicare for all. I will fight for you, for your children, and every American under my presidency.
So right now they're running the 2020 primaries, Democratic and Republican, and every candidate has a full staff and has to raise money, has a war chest, puts out ads, just like a real campaign.
Hi, I'm Jamie Baranoff. I am the election simulation coordinator. I'm also a teacher at Townsend Harris.
So you guys have a crazy year to simulate.
I think we do, yeah. So, you know, the number one rule we say of the simulation is keep it as real as possible. But certainly when we have a Trump, I encourage students to kind of use their best judgment. So I feel like personally, if he says it in the real world, you can say it in the simulation. Wait till you see the boy who's playing Trump.
Good morning, America. Are we recording? Is this live? Good morning, America. How's it going, everybody? My name is Donald J. Trump.
So when Trump was new, when we covered this simulation in 2015, no one had seen Donald Trump as a candidate before. You know, everyone was trying to figure out, it was clear, like, how to be Trump. And the way that the first two students did it was they were really transgressive. They said and did shocking things. And they got in trouble with their teachers for it. Like, you know, one year, one of the students who played Trump in this debate accused Hillary of, quote, PMSing. And it was really bad. It was like, you know, a shock. Everyone like couldn't believe that he had said that. And it was bouncing off of what our actual president said about Megyn Kelly. So this is the third student that I've seen play Donald Trump. And this year, he's being played by a senior named Togai.
Look, you can't impeach winners. My office has been winning for the past 4 years. All right, they can try what they want. You can't impeach a winner.
So what do you think about your rivals in this? Like,
all right. So I think it's boring Bill Weld and City Mark Sanford. I don't remember much about Weld. We had a debate once. I fell asleep. And City Mark Sanford, I can't understand any of his policies. It's a shame. So I can't tell you much about my rivals.
I wanted to talk to Togai, not in character, as Trump.
Can I ask you, as you...
Oh, yeah. Oh, thank God. Thank God. Oh, you don't understand how hard it is to keep a straight face doing that, man. Woo!
What do you think of Trump in real life?
I think, you know, most of what he does is so purposefully, you know, controversial, right? I think that's why he won in 2016.
So is that your strategy in the simulation?
I mean, yeah. I mean, like, my idea is the only way I'm going to win here is to just parody, right? In preparation, I watched Alec Baldwin for a couple weeks to get into the voice, the mannerisms, you know, the hand motions, China, all this sort of stuff. It's all in, you know... Just watching what's been come before and bringing it to Townsend Harris, you know? Here to put on a show.
You know, Townsend Harris, it's a pretty liberal school. It's really diverse. It's a lot of kids from immigrant families, students of color. You just really want to know, what are they going to think of Donald Trump?
For the past 4 years, I, Donald J. Trump, have proven that my administration is an administration of winners. All right, what does that mean? Well, let's just look at the facts, guys. Let's look at the facts. I put hundreds and thousands of Americans back into jobs, back into the coal mines, increasing our energy levels, right? We have more energy, and we're making a huge economy, guys. Huge, all right? And not only is my administration amazing, I also have the most beautiful family, guys. The wonderful Melania, and the very, very beautiful Ivanka Trump. I love my daughter so much. Beautiful Ivanka Trump here. Guys, it looks like we've got a wall to build, all right? That can only happen if you vote for Donald Trump for re-election in 2020, guys, all right? We got a wall to build. Remember, let's keep America great, everybody!
So, yeah, he was a hit. I think it's safe to say. So, at the kickoff rally, all the candidates are there, and they're all trying to make an impression. And another student who really connected was a senior named Justin, who's playing Pete Buttigieg.
Hey, Townsend, I'm Mayor Pete, and I want to be your next president. Now, unlike me, all four of my opponents have been in Washington for a combined 117 years. Biden has sexually groped 7 women, and Kamala Harris has opposed investigating police shootings of Black Americans. I will secure America's future. This isn't about winning an election. It's about winning an era. So come Election Day, remember, pledge to Buttigieg.
Townsend Harris's Mayor Pete just goes right for the jugular. He's transgressive in the same way that Trump is, and it just electrifies the students. So one of the best things about the Townsend Harris simulation is, you know, there's media. So there's not just the candidates. There's, you know, talk radio, there's TV shows, and everyone goes on these shows to defend themselves and to go after each other.
Joe Biden, we get to hear about your kickoff rally experience. How do you feel about it? How'd it go?
Well, for starters, I think that Mr. Buttigieg's attacks on me were not appropriate for such an event. And I would like to say that those sexual allegations are not true, because it is true that after many of my speeches, I have to hug and kiss many people. But it was never my intention to make anyone feel uncomfortable. And I apologize if I have done so.
You know, another great aspect of the simulation is the advertising. And so every campaign can place ads on the campus TV station or the campus radio station. And over the years, the political ads at Townsend Harris have developed their own distinctive style.
Stopping climate change, rest in peace, I'm your superior. Trump, you don't fit the president's criteria. TNN, taking pressure, causing mass hysteria. After I'm done, Trump, you're gonna start tearing up. I'ma start killing this, how you shoot but miss. You're attracted to your daughter, but you got a wife. Trump did nothing, he a dummy, not too bright. Grab him by the pussy, I'm sure that ain't right. Richard Donald was in the office, bugging. Post to his guts, hope Biden don't cut him. Presidential thoughts brought to me with no advisory. When I'm done with you, you'll be drowning in misery. We need free for your college real bad. He was drowning in his tears with anxiety. You know my bars full of clarity. I'll send PD at your dome if you want to keep testing me.
So, you know, one of the things that happened this year is the campaign became sort of a rap battle. And, you know, Mayor Pete had to respond in this rap battle to Joe.
They say, yo, Pete, where you been at? I'm just winning with these. I've been crushing at the polls, that's why GOP on me. I've been through with speaking for y'all past me, Trump C. But no, Biden's making TikToks and not taking the lead. We need changing, 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 gotta check me a vote. I got LGBT rights and I'm a legalized dope. America's going broke and I ain't gonna sit back. While Creepy Joe looks at little girls like they some snacks. But I'm just Pete, vote Buttigieg, trying to be your prez. I'm not like other Dems, just some airheads.
Sponsored by AFL-CIO.
You know, so there's so many ads, and it's not just candidates. There's also ads from special interest groups. One of my favorites this year was from students who were playing the role of the American Family Association.
American Family Association, spreading the good Lord throughout our whole nation. Conservative standards is what we will follow. Media integrity, that is our motto. Pro-life because we don't want to kill babies. Climate change is fake and science is crazy. Protecting our children, defending our borders. We know what's right and we'll put things in order.
Welcome to the 2019 Candidates Debate.
Okay, so first we're going to welcome our Republican candidates. First one up, where's Trump right now?
It was totally amazing. Trump, played by Togai, he didn't just walk onto the stage. He came on riding a hoverboard. And he just glided right into the center of the stage, and he stretched out his arms, and he spun around and around, and the crowd went nuts. So, you know, and it was really interesting to see just, you know, what parts of the real-life Trump's sort of tactical playbook Togai decided to pick up and use for himself at Townsend Harris.
Look, the media does not want me to win. You know how I know why? Because my mic is defunct and I had to borrow it. They do not want me to win. So I would tell you the truth firsthand. I care about the American people. I care about American jobs. I put you guys first. I think we should make sure that all Americans can sleep at night and all Americans' rights are protected, their First Amendment rights, all of their amendment rights. And we can't do that if we have sneaky politicians trying to take over our government. I put you guys first, and that's how American politics should work, all right? Keep America great, everybody.
He didn't really want to show the scary, aggressive, offensive side of Trump. But Trumpism in general seemed to infect the whole election simulation for the first time. And the Democratic candidates treated each other with a level of aggression I hadn't seen before. They really became provocateurs determined to create spectacle.
Well, I'd like to ask Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren. These people come from an era of old politics. How will you better prepare America to a future with all of us as millennials? You guys aren't in touch with the American people and millennials like I am. How will you better prepare the American people for this transition to the new future?
So, you say that I'm not in touch with millennials, but as a mayor, you did nothing for your city, and you also fired your only black PD, which shows you're a racist. And if you're a millennial, why do you only appeal to the rich white man instead of the minorities? What have you done for the minorities? First of all, for civil liberties, I've done way more than you have. I've created the Violence Against Women Act, and I've done way more for this country than you have.
After the debate, I wanted to catch up with Justin, who's playing Pete Buttigieg.
How do you think it went?
I feel like I had, like, pretty good support going for me from the underclassmen. I think that what I need to do next is to take the next step forward is to be especially more critical of Joe Biden and present myself more of like, present the Democrats mostly as a united front against Donald Trump. Yeah. The trouble there is that a lot of the underclassmen like them, so we have to push against them but not to the point where we lose all his voter base to us.
Oh, I see. You have to appeal to the Trump voters on some level.
Yes, so like the ones that don't really want to vote for him but don't want to vote for any Democrats, that's what we're going to try to do. We looked at, like, the recent polls. We're up against Biden by probably around 20%. but we need to keep this momentum going. And that, at the moment, I don't think that I'm like utilizing that momentum enough.
How do you compete with just the sheer celebrity fun of Trump? Like, just by being on stage, people get excited about him.
I think the easy thing about playing Trump is that you don't really have, it's not really about your policies, it's more about your personality. And I think that the kid playing him is doing an amazing job. It's impossible to attack him on his policies in this election simulation because he's running all on his like character, his charisma.
Okay, awesome.
We've been here a couple other years.
Yes.
And this year, I'm surprised to say this, but it seems more cheerful than it has in the past. I remember the Trump-Hillary year. I thought things were, there was more tension and it seemed kind of scarier. And it makes me wonder whether Trump just seems more normal now to kids who have grown up with this.
It could be that. You're right. We're 3 years into the Trump presidency and it's not so shocking as it was back then. I think it's also the personalities. I remember the student who played Trump that year and he didn't have, you know, I hate to say, he didn't have the same kind of charisma as this Trump does. You know, he was a little bit of a darker personality.
So these students, they're seniors, and they've watched previous election simulations. They've seen two previous Trumps, and neither of those Trumps have won. So Togai's Trump is to some extent a response to what's come before. And that's something that Justin, who's the student who's playing Pete Buttigieg, has been thinking about a lot.
So I was here during the first, the actual general presidential election, not the primaries. So I think it's kind of like we see his name so much in the headlines that it kind of numbs us to what he's actually doing. He kind of shifted the norm for us. And in this school especially, like there was some stuff that Donald Trump was saying that if you heard from any other candidate, it would frankly be disgusting. Like he was making jokes about, I'm not criticizing how Togai was playing. He was making jokes about like him and Ivanka and stuff like that. And I think that because we've seen what's actually going on in Washington, because it's kind of been like a reality show to us, this isn't really surprising, and this has been, like, this isn't new. That's why I think the student body is so accepting of Donald Trump and willing to overlook some of his real-life policies in favor of the student playing him.
Good afternoon, Townsend Harris. This is Ms. Baranoff with the election simulation results. The Democratic winner is Pete Buttigieg, and the Republican winner is Donald Trump. Congratulations, everybody.
Check that out. So, I mean, like I said, when I was coming into this, I knew there were three Trumps. I mean, two Trumps before me. I was the third Trump coming into this. And I said, when it comes down to it, I want to be the first Trump to win at Townsend Harris High School. Like I told you, back in freshman year, we had conversations. Everyone was so riled up against him being put into office. And now Townsend Harris put him into office by their own accord. So, yeah, I think I did the impossible.
So he's back in the polls. His opponents are very far behind, far, far behind. Looks like the race is won. He'll become president one more time, one more time.
Josh Rothman is an editor at The New Yorker. Togai, who played Trump in the Townsend Harris High School election simulation, is a graduating senior and he's heading to college in the fall.
Townsend Harris, this is for you. Let's go. I got diamonds, I'm in my priming, these books I'm signing, get it baby, go and vote, cause you know numero uno is living in the White House and I won't move bro, tweet, staying in this race, I'm in the limelight, hear my speech cause now I'm planning out my timeline, every single day in the whole night, my posse is like me, alright, look at me, look at you, take this race, that's what I'm gonna do, I'm a winner baby, what else is new, and now I'm about to trump you, bring it!
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In the early 70s, Pam Grier played leading roles in the genre known as blaxploitation, with films including Foxy Brown. She was really one of the first women to become an action star. Grier is such an icon that she appears in a Call of Duty video game. The New Yorker's Michael Shulman caught up with Pam Grier recently on the set of the sitcom Bless This Mess.
When a woman takes out her earrings and her shoes, she's gonna whoop your behind. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that's in my movies. Okay? And cultures, certain cultures understand that. And other cultures would think it's black exploitation. We don't fight. We're conservative. Black people, we don't do that. The hell you don't. No one fights for us. She has to fight for herself.
Pam Grier joins us next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Gish Jen first came to readers' attention almost 30 years ago. Her debut novel was about an immigrant family from China, and it had the somewhat ironic title, Typical American. Gish Jen's eighth book has just come out, and she talked about it with The New Yorker's Katie Waldman.
The Resistors is a new book that's just come out, and it's a dystopia. It's a dystopic fiction. It is set in a future where there is one class, the netted, who are allied with the internet. The internet, of course, has taken over everything and has permeated every aspect of life. And then there is the surplus class, and their job is basically to consume all of the goods that this privileged caste produces. So the novel follows a surplus family. The daughter is Gwen. She's sort of this wunderkind baseball pitcher. And so she gets scouted to play for the Olympic team. So The Resistors is definitely a book about politics, but it also happens to be a wonderful baseball novel. And it gets at the sort of aesthetic quality of the game, how unpredictable and often beautiful and sometimes boring it can be. So when Gish Jen and I talked recently, we started with baseball. So you live in Cambridge, right? So you must be a Red Sox fan.
I am a Red Sox fan, but I have to say that, you know, I come from a very, very, very strongly, you know, pro-Yankees
really?
Family.
Okay.
Well, yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, what most people have asked me is, you know, are you a baseball fan? And, you know, I will say that baseball is so important to my family that a couple summers ago, my mother, who was in her 90s, was in septic shock. We all thought, of course, that, you know, her time had come. A priest was called in for last rites. She was non-responsive. And my brother leans over my mother and he says to her, Mom, he says, the Yankees are in a slump.
Oh.
The Red Sox are eating their lunch.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, my mother opened her eyes and without missing a beat, she said, that Aaron Boone should be fired. You know, and I think that just says it all. You know, I come from a family of baseball fanatics. My brother was a star pitcher in Yonkers, New York, when I was growing up. And he had a lot of – I think that a lot of our, you know, my ideas about America were tied up with his really classically American experience. I mean, in the sense that there's this immigrant kid. They said, you know, we have this Chinese kid who can throw. In any case, I just bring this up because I do think a lot of the emotional – attachment to baseball is all attached to these early experiences, all those scenes of Gwen practicing in the backyard. I would never have been able to write them without having seen my brother, you know, with a target in the backyard, just throwing and throwing and throwing till he could hit those corners, you know, which he did.
Yeah. Well, and actually, speaking of that, I wonder if I could ask you to read from the passage on page 153. And you're talking about the baseball team that Gwen plays for Auto America and their rival, which is China-Russia, the amalgam of China and Russia. And you're describing why the rivalry is so intense. But in doing that, you kind of get at the symbolic weight of baseball for Americans. And I should back up and say that it's narrated by Gwen, the main character's father.
Okay. Perhaps this was fear pure and simple on the part of Gwen's teammates. But feeding their obsession, of course, was the sense that baseball was more than a sport, that it was a crown jewel. There were people who said it wasn't even invented in America. There were people who pointed out it was mentioned by Jane Austen long before it was ever mentioned here. But if baseball took on a hallowed meaning, it took on that meaning in our American dreams. For was this not the level playing field we envisioned? The field on which people could show what they were made of? And didn't we Americans believe above all that everyone should have a real chance at bat? Didn't we believe that with the good of the team at heart, something in us might just hit a ball off our shoe tops and send it sailing clear out of the park? If Gwen's teammates were playing Chine Rusher for something, I thought, it was for this. For a chance to show, my mother would have said, that even if we all returned to the dirt and the wind and the rain like the plants and the animals, we had a bigness in us, something beyond algorithms and beyond upgrades, something we were proud to call human, or so it seemed to me.
Could you maybe describe just a little bit what's happening with Gwen and baseball when the book begins?
It turns out that she is quite a talented pitcher. And as the book goes on, she comes to the attention of the Netted. They are engaged in international competition, and so they would like to see Gwen come and play for them. She has to decide between a world where she can actually realize herself. I mean, the Netted world is one where they have stadia and there are coaches and, you know, all the things that she needs to be the pitcher that she has it in herself to be. And to stay in the surplus world, she'll never know. You know, can she throw an 85-mile-an-hour fastball? You know, in the surplus world, she will never know that. So, you know, she has to kind of decide whether she would cross this line and also whether it would make any difference, you know? I mean, why stick with the surplus? Is that going to help matters? So she has to ask her some pretty hard questions, as well as the question, of course, of, you know, whether she could bring her family with her. You know, is that betraying something? And, you know, does it do any good for her parents to insist that their affiliation is with the downtrodden?
Yeah, and I think specifically with this book, it's also interesting because you've got this sort of encroaching state and AI. And baseball seems to represent something sort of natural and unaccountable and miraculous. So you've written 8 books, and many of them are realist fiction. And I'm wondering, why did you decide to write a dystopian novel?
Well, of course, dystopias are in the air. I'm hardly the first writer to think to do this. But for me, you know, I was kind of at a funny time of my life in that I was newly an empty nester. My daughter had just gone off to college, and as a parent of someone going out into the real world, I was worried about the future. And so my orientation toward what was going to happen in this country, which had already been there, was really, really pronounced because of my time in life. But there's also another way, I think, in which I wanted to write a dystopia, partly because I wanted to write about our times, but to write in a realistic mode about our times and everything that's happening. You know, we would have nothing but shock and anger, you know, like, oh my God, this is happening. Oh my God, this other thing is happening. And that's not the book I wanted to write. You know, I didn't want to write my book to be all about reaction to these things happening. Mm. I wanted to write about what it would feel like if these things all continued and what if our world became what it could become. You know, what would our lives be like?
Well, it's funny because you wrote a piece in the New York Times when Steve Jobs died, and it was this lovely kind of ode to the early computer as an alternative to the typewriter. and you write, "What came out of this computer was not further from the human heart. It was closer. It was looser, freer, more spontaneous." And this is 2011. And in The Resistors, your vision of technology is so much darker. It's kind of authoritarian force. So I just wonder, like, How did that transformation happen? Do you see it as like a switch flipped from optimism to pessimism, or?
No, I don't think that a switch was flipped. I think that I still see technology as enormously liberating. So I'm not actually a technophobe, but it's hard not to notice that authoritarian governments have managed to take technology and use it in frighteningly effective fashion. So I do spend a lot of time in China. So, you know, I have seen what the Chinese government has been able to do with technology.
Yeah. And when you do go back to China, what do you see?
Well, you know, so I was sitting down to this book in 2017. And, you know, so I saw already that there were cameras in the front of the classrooms. You know, you would have every single question, every single reaction recorded. Obviously, that has a chilling effect. Already at that time, they were piloting their, you know, social credit system. So that was already being rolled out in certain cities. And already, you know, no one could really function there without WeChat. And already it was known that WeChat was censored. And, you know, everybody was aware of these things. So, you know, already it was becoming clear that technology was a hugely effective tool that they now had.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting that one journey of the book is just watching Gwen blossom and her parents being so proud of her as she sort of takes over her own freedom and her own life story. But at the same time, there's kind of this shadow narrative that that's kind of what happened with AI, that humans gave birth to this creature and gave it more and more freedom and more leash, I guess. And then it developed into this kind of nightmare sentience. So I found that sort of symmetry really interesting.
Well, thank you. You're the first person to comment on that. But what you see in that, I think, is that, you know, I myself have a little bit of ambivalence about freedom, you know? Look, I look at autocratic leaders and I am against and I am pro-freedom. But there's another way in which in the case of technology, which, you know, we now are at the point where, you know, chatbots can develop their own language independent of us that we can't even understand. A lot of people are quite unnerved by the fact that if you ask a big tech company, well, how does this work? That even for them, it's a black box and they don't really know. And that kind of thing makes us nervous. How could it not?
The novelist Gish Jen, speaking with The New Yorker's Katie Waldman. Jen's new book is called The Resisters. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining us this week. And don't forget that next week, we'll be joined by a living legend, a term I don't use lightly, Pam Grier. See you then.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.